Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Steve.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week,
we talk about the American midterm elections.
We discuss whether or not the stories about the split between Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump are true.
And we do a bit of crystal ball gazing about what would have happened if there had been no election in 2017. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
How late did you stay up for the midterms?
I actually didn't. I went to bed pretty early, to be honest. I know this is going to annoy a lot of people, but I don't find American politics that interesting for a couple of and I don't find it that satisfying to watch live for a couple of reasons. One, basically all American broadcasters are bad.
There's a lot of sort of slide-in graphics and people in weird, CGI studios and Vox Pops with people saying exactly the things like from the script that you would imagine them to say from that political perspective.
I mean, and also, so obviously an endemic problem that we have talked about and talked about our own partial failure to escape it of journalism during elections is things get covered through the prism of basically people decide what's going to happen and cover it accordingly. The really good thing, though, about British political journalism is basically on election night itself, the academics take over. If you actually think about the BBC's election programme, although in the dead hours you will occasionally have like stuff which ages really badly where the BBC's political editor sits there going like, well, now Ed Miliband's lost, probably the leadership election's going to be a straight-up fight between Chucker and Mooner and Yvette Cooper.
Yes, I know what you mean, but you do is you get an exit poll which has been freakishly accurate.
And a lot of it is dominated by academics going, particularly actually the Radio 4's very good results program, academics going, well, look, this swing means this. We can kind of, but crucially, it actually is results led. Whereas a lot of the time you have this kind of like, we have decided than say, so a really good case of this, right, is, I realize I have no idea how to pronounce his name, Beto O'Rourke.
I think it's Beto, but then I agree. This is also the weird thing about covering American, reading about American stuff, is I've read so much more than I've watched because I've read it through Twitter and through American news sites.
But because that got covered through this, oh, it's close. I mean, that is a phenomenal, and so there are some people sneering about momentum saying, we're going to try and learn from this.
He ran for the Senate race in Texas against Ted Cruz, the former presidential candidate, once memorably described by Marie LeConte as, what's it? He said, like, why does
his
he
face always happy or sad?
It says, I like lasagna, but it's not ordered.
Yeah,
which is, I think, his political epitaph, frankly. But he's kind of pretty hateful, even among Republicans. So there was a lot of excitement that a Democratic challenger could get anywhere near him, really, in Texas. And Beto O'Rourke, whatever it turns out to be, it was a good showing. He ran a really great campaign. He raised a shed load of money.
And also, if you look at the down ballot races in Texas, right, you can. People do vote for the top of the ticket is what draws people out. You can make a really strong case that he just objectively did really, really well. I mean, there are many reasons why I'm skeptical of learning from America, just because American politics, to me at least, is just so different and alien to European politics. And a lot of the time the lessons are either sort of broad and about method or just like, first, spend more money on donuts than you do on your whole campaign. Like, and
give everyone an iPad and like amazingly impressive software, and it's like, yeah, but that's never going to, you know, you also need to have a really impressive candidate. Like, you, but having Barack Obama's strategy is good, but it really helps to also have a candidate as good as Barack Obama.
Yeah, and so I am. However, those are all perfectly sort of good reasons to go. There's not very much you can usefully learn from Beto or Beto or. Yeah, we'll just
should we just give him his own pronunciation that is just the podcast only pronunciation?
John O'Rourke.
Yeah.
I'm allowed to do that because people mispronounce my middle name all the time. So if we assume that a thingamy O'Rourke, if you could learn how to add 8 points to your vote share somewhere, I mean, if you do that in the Labour Party, congratulations, you've just somehow won quite a big parliamentary, you're suddenly governing with a parliamentary majority. So there's an awful lot of, I think, in US journalism, even more of that kind of like, we're going to analyse this through whether or not this is a win and not in a useful way. So I don't tend to watch it live other than when I have to cover it. And because we now, of course, have, NS America, not my shit, not my monkeys.
I think the headlines for me, I read a really interesting piece this morning by Ezra Klein of Vox, which said, like, don't be fooled by the fact. So, okay, for people who haven't caught up on it, the headline is that the Republicans held the Senate. There were fewer of the seats that were likely to, it was a favourable contest for them this time. It will be less favourable next time. But Democrats took the House. So what that means is that they get to have a lot of committees in which they can summon people, berate them for 8 hours. They can subpoena stuff. You know, there is a lot more blocking and scrutiny that they can now do.
Well, also crucially, it does basically, it is sort of the end for Trump's domestic agenda across large chunks of the piece.
But his point was that the unemployment in America is now 3.7%. You know, when Obama won his victory, it was something like 8%. I mean, the economy is booming. And you might say, well, that's a legacy of actually, things necessarily Trump has done. Although there is a kind of argument that the way, Trump's economic policy is the kind of least bad plank of his policy, at least in the short term. But, it comes back to the thing that you've always said about him underperforming a kind of generic Republican in the 2016 race, right? He has very badly underperformed a generic Republican in the midterms, even though on the surface it looks like not a, people want a sort of wholesale rejection of Trumpism where everyone goes, oh my God, we were had. You actually, now you mention it, he is a mad racist demagogue with no respect for democratic institutions. And that's not what has happened. So there is a temptation to be quite soft on him, but I think that is probably incorrect.
Yeah. I mean, so I also read and indeed linked to the Klein blog in my free morning email, guys. Yay. Sign up. So the important thing about the Klein showed both at the last election and this one, and it kind of does come back to my point, that if in 2012 you'd said, so in 4 years' time, everyone knows that Hillary Clinton will be the candidate. Everyone knew that in 2012. Yeah, we'll be the candidate. The Democrats will have lost X number of seats in election in midterms. The economy will be doing at X percent. It will be 8 years. Any political scientist would go, oh, well, the Republican candidate, whoever they may be, is heavily favoured to win. But Hillary Clinton's approval rating at that time, most popular politician in America, may be enough to see her through. And then if you'd said, oh, yeah, by the way, Hillary Clinton's approval rating will have fallen through the floor, they'd go, oh, God, no, the Republicans will win that. And then, of course, he did, but he did. And so it is a similar pattern in that it was basically about as bad as the Senate election could have gone in. And there were a series of, very difficult map because mostly in Republican states. But they ideally needed to have slightly fewer losses in order to be able to set up taking the Senate back. Although it does basically confirm sort of a lot of stuff we kind of already know about American politics. One, that Americans are starting to vote in a more normal way, right? You very rarely anywhere else in Europe do you get somewhere where, Hackney, case in point, just because I'm feeling unimaginative this morning, you don't have a situation in which Diane Abbott wins by loads, Hackney elects, votes for a conservative mayor, and the council is Lib Dem. You just do not get that type of
political variation
in most countries. Now, the US is starting to become more normal in the the big reasons why the Democrats won the popular vote and also won the House back is, and there were a number of Republicans in Senate in congressional districts which Hillary Clinton won by quite a big way, and there aren't very many of those people left this morning. So the difficulty that the Republicans have, even though obviously at the moment they have managed it, is it is very hard for their coalition to win the presidential election. They obviously did not win a popular, you know, the popular vote, and they had a very narrow electoral college win last time. Similarly, it is very difficult for the Democratic coalition, because the Republicans are so strong in so many small states, to win a Senate majority. Of course, they possibly could, but they equally might not. The other big problem is the American Constitution. I mean, in many ways, is very poorly designed, but crucially, it's not designed for political parties to behave like modern political parties.
Go on.
If you have a situation in which it's built around the idea that the legislature and the executive will cooperate, and the second that they don't, and also crucially, that the minority has a fair amount of power as well.
Mm.
And the different franchises, as it were, obviously that's slightly evolved since the original, all do slightly incline you to throw out different election results. And they also give astonishing amounts of power to their elected officials, right? For example, again, to use the UK, although there were, you know, council seats and the Conservatives lost last time and they weren't very happy about it, and there were, of course, places where Labour lost ground, no one was saying, oh God, well, now that we've lost some more Labour seats on Barnet Council, the election's going to be even harder to win because they're going to move all of the polling districts in the Labour wards to, you know, a trench at night where you have, like, first answer me these riddles three.
This is the thing that I really took from reading the coverage, is that I think we often do this as a kind of exercise about trying to imagine a foreign correspondent as if you were going to the DRC reporting on America's election, right? And the corruption is just insane. You get the situation where people are tossed off electoral rolls. You have to bring in 15,000 forms of ID. You know, the felony laws are so stacked that actually you end up disenfranchising just huge amounts of and very specific populations, unsurprisingly not the ones that tend to vote Democrats. And you have to queue for, I mean, people were queuing for 3 or 4 hours. I think that's the thing that's really hard to encounter. You know, I'm sure this happened to you last election day. I wandered into my local primary school. I brought my polling card because I'm good like that. I said my name. They had a little tiny pencil. They crossed off my name. I went in, I took my slip and I did it. That was it. And nonetheless, electoral fraud in Britain is tiny, absolutely tiny. But America has this incredibly harsh system about trying, and it will ask for forms of ID that often people don't have. And also, incredibly unfairly, there are grotesque cases of people who, say, voted while they were on probation and didn't realise that that was an offence and have ended up jailed for literally years. I mean, it is an incredibly capricious system that is almost designed to intimidate certain populations out of voting where it can't actually make it physically much harder for them to do
so. Yeah, and that is the aim. And I think you're exactly right about how one ought to cover it. One of the things I always find a bit grating about the coverage of US elections is there were so many people on Twitter yesterday, lol, why do they have these long lines? Haven't these people heard of pen and paper? And it's one of those things where it's like, no, guys, this isn't an accident, right? It's not in these hick Americans accident. As you say, like, it is about intimidating specific groups of people into going, look, we're going to make it really difficult for you to vote. And then with this added complete breakdown of the cultural taboo on visible cheating. So in Georgia, which may go to a runoff if neither candidate gets 50% of the vote plus one, you have a situation in which the candidate for the governorship, his current job...
This is a Republican
candidate. Yeah, yeah. Is effectively the elections rules administrator. He has visibly... And this is, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people in the United States who are angry about it, but it's kind of... It's baked into the political conversation that he will do this, and if he wins, it's not like the other Republican governors will go, well, that guy is a criminal, and this is against all our values. It's like, well, we won, them's the breaks.
I think that's the thing I found absolutely fascinating about it, and something that's bizarre, because obviously I've been researching my book, sorry to mention it, almost as much as you mentioned your free morning email, but the amount of stuff that people will just accept because that's the way it has always been, I think that is just one of the most powerful forces in politics. And in the case of American elections, the idea that actually, you know, you have to kind of run through a hailstorm to vote is, to anybody who has ever just wandered into their primary school with a pencil, is just incredible.
Yeah, and I think the thing I found, this odd debate about, you know, whether or not it's a wave, election, which is one of those things which I just think, A, this is a weird preoccupation for reporters to have. But to the extent that it matters, well, yes, obviously, if you win by 9 percentage points...
which is what the Democrats seem to have done in the popular vote, right?
Then you have definitely won in a wave or a landslide. Now, obviously, our electoral system throws out disproportionate responses, but although people might intuitively go, wait, did David Cameron really gain that many seats? They understand that David Cameron had a phenomenally good night because he gained 97 seats in 2010, but because of how badly Michael Howard had done in 2005, he wasn't here. People understand that. And even though there is sadly not anywhere near as much of a groundswell for changing our electoral system as I would like, there does at least seem to be a basic understanding that...
More votes equal more seats.
Yeah, or at least ought
which
to
breaks
equal more seats.
Sometimes in the case of the SNP wave in 2015, right, it just so happened that you just reached a tipping point where actually the result was very disproportionate. Oh. And it got, you know, UKIP got hammered the other way because their vote was too disparate.
And indeed this weird thing where, so Labour have managed this very elegant thing where the Labour Party has managed to unilaterally declare PR for elections for itself. I realised this the other day going back, then basically since 2015, in the last two elections, the Labour Party is basically getting a proportionate share of parliamentary seats. Of course, their big problem is no one else is getting a proportionate share of parliamentary seats. But it was one of those things, like, oh, that's a nice coincidence.
What, so they got 40% of the vote and 40% of the seats
essentially that's kind of what you would expect, like De Hont or whatever, to spit out for them.
It's too early in the morning for De Hont, Stephen. Let's leave it there.
For a couple of decades between the First and Second World Wars, something mysterious happened. There were murders in country houses, on golf courses, in far-flung parts of the globe and quaint English villages. No fictional character was safe. Because these events were all fictional, the plots of novels that flooded the market in the 1920s and 30s. People couldn't get enough of all of the inventive ways that writers like Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, and more could think of for people to die. This period came to be known as the Golden Age of detective fiction, and for good reason. So that's what I'm going to be doing in this podcast, telling the stories that lurk in the shadows of the famous detective novels. If you've ever stayed up late reading under the covers to find out who done it, then this podcast is for you. Find us at shedoneitshow.com, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as She Done It Show, and in all major podcast apps.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In your column this week, available in all good news agents, you've written about these ongoing burbling rumours about a split or a kind of frosting. That's the thing you have on cake, isn't it? Never mind.
I did briefly type the word Freudeur, but then I realised I don't know how to pronounce it. I think I'm going to seem like a wanker if I use this word in copy. And so I didn't.
Oh, that's good.
But I think it's a Freudeur or a Freudeur.
Freudeur. Between John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, which has kind of had it come out in a couple of different news stories. There's been one about the tax wrangle post the budget. There was one about whether or not Seb Corbyn, who is currently chief of staff, and has been demoted in the McDonnell team. And there was another one as well, which was like he didn't come to his birthday party. No, what was it? Come on, what was the last one?
Was there a story that they hadn't spoken for a week or something? Or
something about like not running interviews past the leadership.
Oh, so yeah, it was in John McDonnell started announcing in interviews in order to get around the fact that the leader's office doesn't sign things off.
So you are not impressed with this theory that it is Blair Brown all over again. Tell me why.
So I think there are a couple of sort of reasons. I mean, one, and I'm aware this is something in podcast listeners are tired of me saying, but it is nonetheless true that their relationship is a lot more like Cameron and Osborne's. Now, yes, Osborne did occasionally kind of would just roll his eyes at, you know, going, why are we having a referendum on the EU being a case in point? But Osborne understood that there were bits of the electorate than Cameron could reach, and he couldn't. And he understood the importance of that project. And that is essentially the same. And crucially, they have a much more enduring and long-standing friendship. The other reason why I kind of sort of roll my eyes about it is a lot of it, I think, is based around people believing two myths about those two men, right? So the first myth, of course, is this thing that, yeah, and it's obviously within the business of politicians to try and turn themselves into legends. And I think McDonnell is broadly right about the legend he's trying to craft to himself, which is, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm stable and dull and
kind of boring bank manager,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like it makes sense. And part of the story, his story, is this whole, like, you know, it was in 1992 when I lost, you know, he wheeled out on Newsnight this week. Yeah, in 1992 when I lost, I realised, you know, you've got to reassure people on tax, which, I mean, it's...
So that's in the 92 election. The Tory, he contested the Tory candidate in Hayes and Harlington, which is now his seat, but the Tories won it as part of the major win. So his theory from that is now that actually that was that the tax bombshell election?
That was the tax bombshell.
Right. So that's now, that's why he's now backing the Philip Hammond tax cuts.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's one of those things where it's a great story and, like, more power to them. I mean, the problem is, though, is if you think about it for more than 2 minutes, it's obviously not true, is it? I mean, if that is the case, that's a great explanation for John McDonnell in 2017. Is the contention of people that he was replaced by a duplicate when he was laying down shadow budgets to Gordon Brown, saying they hadn't been brave enough on tax and spend, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, of course, that is not the case, right? Then if there
well,
is,
not least because the 2017 manifesto had hikes on people earning over 80,000 and 150,000. Like, he's not against taxing people more.
Yeah, no, I mean, also in 2015, in the leadership campaign, which he ran, Jeremy Corbyn was talking about increases in basic rate. I mean, you know, from a wonkish perspective, in my view, that is probably a nettle you've got to go and grasp at some point. But that, you know, but obviously I don't have to try and win elections, so it's very easy for me to say that. And it's one of those things where, you know, it's a myth that people want to believe because it's true of so much of the Labour Party, but it's very hard to stack up the idea than McDonnell is this ultra-cautious person who is, as a result, deeply falling out with everyone around him. The other myth, I think, then it kind of sustains it, because for it to be true, it, unlike TBGBs, right, where, you know, Gordon Brown would do something, Gordon Brown's staff would do something, Tony Blair's staff would do it back, and vice versa, is that they require this idea that the leader's office is a largely passive entity. So, you know, as I, you know, when I do my column, the first stage before I've even decided the topic is I call people semi at random and kind of go, like, how do you feel stuff is going? And, you know, one of the things I mentioned was, yeah, well, look, there are all of these stories. What do you think about them?
Mm.
And because Corbyn is, you know, polite and courteous and makes time for people, and he has this image as a kind of, like, you know, like
magic
socialist
grandpa.
Dumbledore kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
People, I think, often kind of think that means that he's like, and also because he's excessively loyal to people who are terrible at their jobs who've stuck by him, people have this idea that he's therefore, like, soft or daft. This idea that if Seb Corbyn had been demoted as an act of revenge against Jeremy Corbyn would just be like, well, shucks, I guess I can't do anything about that, seeing as I'm only the hegemonic leader of the Labour Party. I mean, it's mad, right? It's based on this idea that he is some kind of cuddly, like, you know, slightly simplistic grandpa figure who's wandered into politics by accident. Now, the odd thing is, although John McDonnell has taken to Twitter to go, look, these stories about a split between us aren't true, then this idea that, you know, John McDonnell is, you know, cautious and scarred by 1992, and Jeremy Corbyn is a lovely granddad who's, like, you know, so butter wouldn't melt in his mouth that someone would demote his son out of revenge, and he'd just be like, well, I guess, and I'm not going to use any of my powers to defund your office or in any way punish you for this act of vengeance against my literal flesh
child
and blood. Like, it's helpful to them that people don't still, despite how close they are to power, still don't see them as a serious political movement to win an election from the left.
There we go. So we've debunked Grandpa Jeremy and Bank Manager John. Thank you very much, Stephen. And now for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
Amazing, amazing intensity. Tell me what people are asking us, Stephen.
So I really like this question because I love a good hypothetical history. This is from Noah. What would be the current state of British politics if Theresa May hadn't called a snap election in April 2017?
Ooh, shiny. So first of all, she... Well, Okay, we have to do Brexit first, right? Do you think she'd have more of a domestic agenda alongside Brexit? Do you think she'd be trying to bring back grammar schools? Like, that would stuff would still be hovering around the place. All that stuff that got just tossed overboard.
Well, I mean, so the domestic stuff, she would still have this problem that she didn't have a big enough parliamentary majority to do any of it, and Whitehall would still be preoccupied with Brexit. I think the big and crucial difference would be that now they have no domestic agenda because of Brexit, but we also know that there is never going to be a domestic agenda because there is no parliamentary majority. And the things she wants, she's far too weak to do for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, no one even really has to pretend that grammar school, this thing, and basically, like, you know, one of the reasons why Justine Greening was sacked was her failure to not sneer whenever she went, well, yeah, of course we'll roll out some more grammar schools. I hear they haven't been utterly discredited by every serious study of how they work.
I guess the economics is the one thing that probably wouldn't be different, right? Because the reason that they called that election is because Philip Hammond couldn't get through his budget, really. Always going to have lots of things going to have to be kind of tossed out off the side of that budget. And what he did in light of them not having a majority in this budget was, you know, really loosen the string. So I think that would have just still happened anyway. I don't think they would have come back round for another budget that had tough to pass measures, even with a small majority.
Well, so the weird... I mean, there are many, I was about to say the weird thing about the choices they made in the 2017 manifesto and then realised that that was a very bold use of a definite article. One of the many weird things about the 2017 manifesto, right, is the problem in 2015 is it's a coalition document, right? It's designed to make the Lib Dems the party of tax rises, yada, 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 and to just force them to, like, make you do a bunch of stuff that actually makes your life easier as the Conservative Party. And instead they ended up committed to... an even more disproportionate cuts-based way of having the public spending commitments met, which turned out to be politically impossible because it, you know, ended Osborne's career. And so obviously every study shows the vast majority of the Brexit vote was not about austerity. Every study also shows enough of the Brexit vote was about those recent cuts. Then without them, we would still be in the EU, albeit with a very, very close-run thing. So the thing is, all of the, but they didn't use the manifesto to get rid of their really silly commitments on tax. Mm. They actually didn't use that mandate for anything. The interesting question I have is, the thing that has vanished is you would talk to, you know, civil servants, ministers, Conservative MPs, and no matter how they felt about Theresa May, they then had to go, of course, she's 20 points ahead in the polls and she's going to be prime minister for 1,000 years. So I guess I've got no choice but to go along with it. You know, the most important thing to have in politics is in terms of controlling your party, is the ability to take lasting revenge. If you're going to vanish in a month's time, I mean,
your powers of patronage and non-patronage are no longer good. Well, the other thing, I guess, is that we would probably have a Brexit deal already, right? Because she would have, the backstop in Ireland wouldn't be such an issue.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is the thing. Although there are a number of Conservative one of the really fascinating ways in the 2017
election... Do they really care enough, actually, when it comes to it? Do they care about Northern Ireland enough?
Well, so I think, this is a way in the 2017 election has really changed history because... They do now, partly because they're all on the record saying it, and they've worked themselves up into a lather on it. But it's a bit like this revisionism about the welfare bill, right? Where people pretend that the point wasn't to send a signal about being tough on welfare. There's like this parallel universe narrative, just like I distinctly remember A, being briefed, and B, giving quite a flattering write-up to why the leadership thought this was a good idea.
You mean under Harman, during the 2015 Labour leadership election, they abstained on the second reading, vote against it at the third reading, which was a kind of like, we're thinking about it, but there's some stuff in there that we like, but actually, no, come on, that's bad panda.
And yeah, there's now been like this sort of myth-making about how it was actually more complex than that because of Labour's internal politics. And it's just one of those things where it's just like, and the thing is, clearly a lot of the people who repeat this on Twitter and indeed in the PLP do believe this to be true. It's just I do have the recordings of the original briefings and I know that this is not true. And similarly with Conservative MPs, people who are saying it's fine, the solution on the Irish border is just for Northern Ireland to enter the same, to have customs port entrance points at ports, because they ended in a situation where they were dependent on the DUP, they've now started to go, no, we could never do this. And it's like, I mean, loads of you the number of people who kind of, have sort of, memory hold what they believed about that. But the that memory holding is, it is like the welfare bill stuff, right? It doesn't really matter other than to, obviously it does matter what the truth is in terms of what we write, but it doesn't really matter in terms of what politicians do if what they say is not what they used to believe. If they sincerely believe it, then that is the crucial difference. And I think then on Brexit, we would be heading towards a Canada-style deal with effectively Northern Ireland, shuttered off from the rest of it. I guess the other interesting question, right, is would the transformation in Jeremy Corbyn's opinion poll ratings and indeed the size of the parliament, and Labour's poll position have happened without a snap election? I can't work out how it would have.
That's really interesting, because you're right, because at that point, in the same way that there's no test of Theresa May, what we know about Corbyn from his poll ratings now is that they're really not great. And the explanation being that for a large amount of his supporters, they need to see him. They want, when he's not out there front and centre in an election campaign, he's kind of disappears off their grid. So he's not getting that kind of, he's not sustained the kind of ratings he had last year. So there's every reason to suggest that he wouldn't have improved his poll ratings without that election campaign.
Yeah. And I think, the fascinating question is, the fascinating question is, given how bad the polls were, given how bad the local elections, which were kind of before the campaign kicked in, so I think it feels certain to me that the local elections would have been that bad, given Labour's position on Brexit, which was, not in a position that was exactly aligned with the sympathies of the membership, given all of that, could there have been a shift in how Labour Party members felt about Jeremy Corbyn? And the weird thing is in theory, yes, but in practice, his internal opponents would have found a way to mess it up because they're just too divided. The reason why I don't like the word, there are lots of reasons why I don't like the word Labour moderate, but the reason why I think it's actually a useless term is that it implies a level of purpose and unity to Corbyn scepticism. Mm-hmm. If they all thought one way, they would probably be more effective, whereas of course the problem is that they continually undermine one another because they're all in such different political positions. So I suspect you'd have a much more querulous Labour Party. The fascinating thing is, right, so obviously we've kind of forgotten this, because
do you think there would have been a split?
Well, so this to me is the other thing, right? So one of the major deterrents to a split is what happened to the Lib Dems at the last election versus what was happening to the Lib Dems in by-elections and council elections. And I, again, the kind of Tim Farron's, reproductive and sexual rights problems would not have been exposed outside of a real election.
Mm-hmm.
No one in a local election goes,
Tim Farron hates abortion.
Yeah, that wouldn't obtain. So, you therefore assume the Lib Dems are doing a bit well. I think we can also safely assume that the various, the mural, what was the one between the mural and the English irony remark? The wreath. All of that stuff would have happened, but splitting would feel less risky, I think, to a lot of people.
Okay, so that's where we are then. If election hadn't happened, our prediction is still no domestic agenda, but everyone's a bit less happy about that in the Tory party. Corbyn still looking extremely ropey but unmovable, possibly a split, and maybe Lib Dem fight back. Just think what we could have had. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is from the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not subscribe to Stephen's free morning email? I'm sure you haven't heard about that before, but it is still brilliant. Just simply Google Stephen Bush Morning Call.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.